case, Dong v. Sterling Collision.
May it please the court, Jeffrey Tarrin representing the plaintiffs. The Sterling Auto Body technicians involved in this case are not plainly and unmistakably commissioned employees within the meaning and spirit of the 7i exemption of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Unlike any other commission exemption situation dealt with by the courts, the wages of these mechanics, painters, and car cleaners are directly controlled by the clocked hours that they worked.
Aren't they essentially piecework people? I mean, there's this fictional booked hour, you know, so much for a fender, so much for a radiator, you know, whatever it is they're doing. And if they do five fenders in a day, they get a certain amount of compensation. If they do two fenders in a day, they get less. With this national average book, which strikes me as incredible, frankly. I don't know how you can be doing 110 hours worth in 50 or 45 hours and have the national average remain at such a high level. Reminds me a little bit of Lake Wobegon. All procedures are above average. But nonetheless, I mean, I think we do need in this compensation formula to understand what at bottom the basis of compensation is before we can apply the Fair Labor Standards Act.
And in fact, we agree that there is an aspect of piecework that is involved in this case, because a computer is assigning X amount of hours for each fender or each door, regardless of how many hours they actually work. And if you do 10 fenders, you're getting paid by the fender. There's also an aspect of hourly wages because of the way the team concept that was put into play by Sterling goes in, and that is that each individual has their own individually negotiated hourly rate, and Sterling divides up the team's hours according to actual clock hours worked. So if one individual is off 4 hours because he's sick, his wages are reduced proportionately by the 4 hours that he left. Some of the facilities reduced it by shifts.
Sure, but of course he can make it up if he's a fast worker. Right, I mean, in a system like this, if you're a fast worker, you really control your own time.
But there's still the formula, actual hours over team hours, that gets multiplied times essentially the piecework, the booked hours?
That's correct. But Judge Posner, to answer that question, in this system, he does not necessarily have the individual ability to make up those hours. He doesn't have control of the number of hours that he's working. He's part of a team. He's doing some aspect of the work. He is not gathering in the work like a salesman who has the ability to go out and solicit additional jobs or cars to sell.
If it were a good team, right, they could do all their work in the morning and go play golf.
Except it doesn't work that way. That might be an aspect, and we believe it is, that the independence that a true commissioned employee have is one of the elements and aspects of commissions and one of the purposes behind the 7i exemption. But these individuals work...
I don't understand why it's so different from it, why it's particularly different from a salesman paid on a commission basis. He may work 40 hours a week, 50 hours, 20 hours... But however hard he works or doesn't work, his income is determined by his commission. So these people, if you're fast and if you're on a good team, you can, you know, do very, very well in very few hours. And if you want to work more and, you know, make a lot of money, you can do that.
But unlike the salesman, these individuals don't have control of their own hours. They're working 5 day weeks, 50.
Most salesmen don't have control of their own hours. I mean, it's different between a salesman who's an employee and a salesman who's an independent contractor. You may be employed as a salesman and you were supposed to work 40 hours a week, whether you work more or less or average that or whatever. But the point is your income is decoupled from the number of hours you work. Here, the only relation really, the only significance of the hours is it's your hours relative. It's not the number of hours you work. It's the number of hours you work relative to the other people on the team.
But that's a significant difference, and really
well,
it takes
it. Can I just ask a point of clarification, though? If is there some requirement? Suppose they finish all the jobs that they have to do in the morning. Is there some requirement that they have to stay around anyway during the afternoon in case somebody brings in a banged-up car that afternoon? In other words, might they be sitting around the shop with nothing to do?
There was no evidence that was presented to the district court that showed anything other than that these workers work a full five-day week, 45 hours
a week. So they might be
week.
Sitting there with nothing to do even if they finish the jobs that are there that morning because new work might come in. I mean, it's a customer-driven, I suppose.
It's theoretically
workflow.
Possible, but the suggestion
they
to us...
They don't pay anything, right?
Pardon me?
They're not paid while they're sitting around.
They're paid as long as they're working, and they had a
right.
steady stream,
so
a steady stream of work.
But if they're steady stream. Look, there are down days in every job. If they're just sitting around waiting for the next battered car to come in, they're not being paid. They're not earning anything.
If they're not, that's correct. Right. If they're not booking hours, they would
right.
not
so
be earning.
It's really quite different from a standard job where you're paid. By the hour, right? These people could have a week and not be paid anything.
Well, except that's not the case in this situation.
Case, right?
And in fact, that's why
the way they've structured their employment relation, they've actually shifted. The employer shifted a certain amount of risk to the employees. No work, no pay, right?
That's again theoretically correct, but it is not any of the facts related to the way Sterling operated.
I actually believe that because there isn't any in a business of this sort. You're not going to have a steady stream of broken cars, right? They're not going to be steady. It's going to be irregular, and people are going to come in. They're going to say, "Well, my car repaired immediately." A bunch of other cars there, so
well,
that's why these people want to be able to work overtime.
The difference here, of course, is that we have a chain of collision repair stores that are owned by an insurance company so that they can routinize the process and avoid the fluctuating income which we see in true commission.
They can't routinize because if you have, you can diversify your financial risk by having collision centers all over the United States. But if a car breaks down in New York, you can't send it to your California collision center to repair it because they're having a slack day.
Well, these are primarily local collision repair centers throughout the country.
And there are going to be fluctuations in the number of accidents and breakdowns and so on in a local area. So there are going to be times when these people are just sitting there and they're not being paid.
Well, Your Honor, the stipulations in the record, at least with regard to the two named plaintiffs, show that these individuals over a 52-week year worked steadily, 40-plus hours every single week. We don't have that situation where you have feast or famine, as we did in Mech.
You mean they were paid?
They were paid and they...
For more than 40 hours every week?
No, that they actually worked more than 40 hours.
No, but that's irrelevant because they're right. If
they were on site,
it's not when they're present. They're not on the site. That's not what's important. They're actually working on a job. So are you saying that every week they worked on jobs at least 40 hours?
That's what the record indicates. That they were working steadily. It's our position that the fiction here is that this is really a commission, that Sterling has devised a way to get around the overtime laws. And if you're effectuating and advancing the legislative purpose, as this court suggested in Mechmet, and you compare the banquet waiters in Mechmet to the individuals here, you find what the only courts that address this situation, that is Judge Rustani's dissent in Kleindienst and the opinion in Wilkes.
What if you had a salesman and you said, you know, you're going to work every day, but we're going to pay you on the basis of assigned number of hours for every particular sale. So if you sell a washing machine, we're going to say that's an hour. But if you sell an air conditioning system, we're going to say that's 5 hours. So if you can sell the washing machine in less than an hour, you can sell the air conditioning system in less than an hour, you'll be paid as if you will be paid 1 hour, 5 hours worth. Now, would that also be subject to the overtime rules?
At that point, you're getting closer to what the purposes of the 7i exemption was.
That's identical to what's going on here, except for the team feature. That's the only difference.
And the clocked hour feature, the fact that people are being paid based on the number of hours that they actually work.
That's the team feature. Don't you understand? They have to have some hourly count because they're working in teams. They have to allocate the returns, the pay among the team members. If each was working alone, it would be like my salesman case, right?
Well, in Mechmet, they allocated without regard to the number of hours that were worked. That was a team concept, and they allocated
That's
according
one way
to rank.
It. Sure, but another way would be to say, you know, we have to figure out how to compensate the team members. We can do it on the basis of their we can treat them equally, or we can do it by time or something like that, or by their age or who knows what. The mere fact they use hours relative to another person doesn't mean they're paying on an hourly rate.
Well, Your Honor, I'd have to bring this back again to the purposes of the FLSA as expressed in the Mechmet case and whether they bear any relationship to these workers here. And I would suggest that the non-union individuals, Mechmet was union individuals, who are not feasting or famine week by week in an industry where they need protection because it's a dangerous industry, fit exactly the purposes of the FLSA.
That's an odd argument because you emphasize they have steady employment, 40 hours week in, week out, no feast and famine, and very high, you know, for skilled labor. Not white collar work. They have very nice incomes. So
some of them do. The hourly rates start at $6.25 an hour for the painters. The tech ones are essentially people who clean cars. So while it's true that the two named plaintiffs were the most experienced technicians, they are the minority, and we are representing 187 of these technicians
but
in this case.
Your class representatives are supposed to be representative. Now you're saying they're not representative.
No, we would not concede that. They are. In the material ways, they are representative.
Both ways.
It's an opt-in class.
It's a very special kind of class under the statute.
That's correct. I do note I'm over my time.
That's fine. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Tarrant. Mr. Henke?
Thank you. My name is Rex Heinke. I'm here with my colleague, Bob Leon, on behalf of the appellee, Sterling
Mr. Heinke,
Centers.
I'd like you to explain to me the difference fundamentally between this system and a piecework system, because as I understand it, people who have genuine piecework do not fall within this commission exception to the Fair Labor Standards Act. And so if you're, say, a furniture maker and you get paid by the chair you construct, you know, if you're really a good carpenter or furniture maker, maybe you can make 10 chairs a day. And if you're a beginner, maybe you can only make one chair a day. And so there's an incentive, of course, to be efficient. There's an incentive to work harder. And maybe your employer has some expectation that you'll do five. But you're still somehow not in the commission system. And what this looks like to me is this giant list of procedures that can be done for cars is something where there's just sort of an artificial number associated with them. And the better you are at doing fenders or painting or what have you, the more you get done. But why isn't this really just a fancy piecework system?
I thought you might ask that, Your Honor, based on your earlier question. I think the answer to it is this. In a piecework system, you are doing exactly the same task. You're building the same chair one time after another time after another time. Or in the Department of Labor opinion letter that deals with health and athletic clubs, you're giving the same lesson one time and then again and then again.
Well, but there's a difference with the athletic clubs, because if you're going to give somebody an hour-long tennis lesson, you can't give two lessons in that hour. Whereas in my chair hypothetical, if you're good, maybe you can make two chairs in an hour, maybe you can make one chair in an hour, maybe you can only make half a chair in an hour. But it's that at least strikes me as different from the opinion letter.
I agree. It's different from the opinion letter. But my point is that with the chair, you have the same task repeated one time after another. The whole essence of this system is the inability to figure out what it's going to take on a precise basis to fix a car, because the nature of the damages are so different. And so you have this.
Why does that matter to whether it's piecework or not? Because for each car, you figure out a set of tasks, and you get this phony number associated with them. And you say, okay, well, for this car, you know, it's a dented right rear fender, and we're going to have to replace a panel, and we're going to have to do some paint work, and we're going to have to do whatever else you do for the dented fender. But for each task, you have various particular things that one has to do.
There's no doubt about that, Your
Honor.
And
so there's a weighting. Maybe some tasks are harder than others, but in the end, it's just pieces.
Well, it's pieces, but it's a complex task. It's kind of like saying what a lawyer does is a whole bunch of pieces.
Why does that take us over to commissions, though? Just because it's a five-step process instead of a one-step process.
I don't believe that as such takes us to commissions, but I think it distinguishes this situation from the commission situation. Why is it like a commission situation? Because ultimately what they're getting paid is tied in to the sales cost here.
Well, that's why I'm not sure. What they're getting paid certainly has a lot to do with how efficient they are, how many tasks they can accomplish in a day. But it seems to me the same could be said of somebody who's paid on a piecework basis.
Sure, but there, Your Honor, you're able to figure out over time exactly how much time, basically within a fairly narrow range, as to how many chairs you can produce a day or how many ashtrays.
Well, supposedly that's what you can do with this, too. You have these national averages, and you hire people, of course you want to build some incentive in them to be better and to get more done. But it seems to me you could do precisely the same thing.
But in fact, that doesn't work. That's the whole nature of this system. The booked hour system is you can't figure that out. All we've got are these averages.
They're not really averages, of course.
Well, you have to understand the industry. There are people who are like my client, but there are a lot of mom-and-pop operations which are nowhere near as efficient. So that's why they're averages.
Does anybody ever feed this data back into the national system? Does Sterling send its actual data about how long it takes to do a fender back to whoever it is?
I believe so, Your Honor, but we're a very small portion of the total industry, so whatever our numbers are aren't going to affect the averages a lot. This is not an industry that is dominated by big companies. This is an industry that is dominated by mom-and-pop operations, small body shops, a couple people, a handful of people. So their numbers here really control destiny. Ours do not.
But anyway, I mean, I have a hard time given the notion of a commission, which strikes me could either be, you know, a salesman sells a car and for every car he sells he gets $500, or a real estate agent sells a house and for every house she sells she gets 6% of the sales price. This seems to me to be a step removed from that.
Well, it's certainly not a sales commission. We do not contend it's a sales commission. On the other hand, the statute does not require a sales commission. It talks
statute
about
doesn't define the term commission, does it?
It does not. And so this court in the Mehmet versus Four Seasons case said there's no core definition of commission.
But so in Mehmet, of course, there was the banquet fee, and then there was a percentage on top of that fee, very much like the real estate commission. There's a percentage. It was a function of the fee. And then, of course, instead, because it wasn't just one person, it got allocated among people. I don't think that's an important detail.
Right. But, Your Honor, I think the question is, how do you analyze this and reach a result here? And we suggest that Mehmet provides the roadmap. And there,
but what Mehmet says is this is a classic dictionary commission. And then it goes on to say and this result makes sense given the purpose of the statute. You're trying to go from the purpose back into something that strikes me as a very strained dictionary definition.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. I do not believe that Mehmet says this meets the definition of a sales commission. I believe what Mehmet says is that the commission, the definition of a commission, is simply not clear, and therefore to determine the meaning of commission, we must look at the purposes of the FLSA. And I believe that's what needs to be done here.
That labor letter says a commission rate is not bona fide if the formula for computing a commission is such that the employee, in fact, almost always earns the same fixed amount of compensation for each work week.
Right. And that did not happen here, Your Honor.
Well, that's sort of the negative, but that still leaves the question. That's an example of what's not a bona fide commission rate. But what is the commission element?
Well, I think there are two aspects.
They're being paid a percentage of their booked hourly rate. Is that the critical percentage that makes it like a commission?
Yes, because the booked hours are keyed into the ultimate price of the consumer. And then what you get paid as one of our technicians is keyed into that number.
Your core conception of a commission is that instead of being a payment of a fixed rate per hour, per week, or something like that, it's a percentage.
But I thought that's
not what it
was.
In this case, is the booked hours divided by the it's the booked hours times your ratio of your working hours to the rest of the team.
Right.
Times your flat rate,
times
though.
Your
yes.
rate.
You
times
come
your
up
rate.
With some rate based on how. Yeah. So the booked hours is more a time factor than it is something that dictates your flat rate.
Well, but
of course, there's always a fixed rate. There's always a fixed something at the end of the commission rate. It's always a percentage.
Right.
Where are the booked hours in a percentage? There's a ratio of actual hours by you versus over actual hours by your team. That ratio is then multiplied times the booked hours to come up with your share, and then it's multiplied times your flat rate.
Certainly, Your Honor, but it's not really much different. Think about a sales commission. Let's say you've got two real estate brokers and they both work on the same deal. You need some way to allocate who gets how much of that commission. The other additional twist here, which is the flat rates, is we don't have people who are uniform. That is, there's very different skill levels here, and understandably those people are being compensated relative to their contribution.
But I'm having trouble seeing how this turns it into a commission, because of course in the real estate example you just gave, you start out with a bona fide sales commission, and here you start out with just a ratio of how much of the team's work are you going to do, and if you just multiplied that times your flat rate, you'd come up with a number that I think we would all agree is not a commission. It's that when you put those booked rates into the equation is when you somehow think it turns into a commission. But the booked rates are just a way of estimating how long somebody thinks it should have taken.
Right, but it's ultimately like setting a price.
Well, it looks a lot like fixing a price to me, actually, but you don't want to go there.
Well, I suppose maybe that's a different case someday, Your Honor, although we don't think that that's setting a price. We look at those as guidelines. But in any event, I submit that it's really not...
The booked hours or the price?
Yes.
Booked hours
That's what gets charged to the customer.
No, the booked hours are not what gets charged to the customer.
That corresponds to the estimate that was given at the beginning of the job.
But you calculate a number of hours that you think it's going to take to fulfill the task.
Right.
Okay? But then you take those hours, calculate the relative income.
Yeah, okay. I understand how the formula works at the end of the process to compute the pay, but I'm talking about the individual task that has been estimated at the beginning of the process when the car comes in, the number of flag hours that it's going to take. Once that task is completed, that's when the hours are booked, but then that's what gets charged up to the customer, I think is the import of the question.
Right. Yes.
Okay. So in other words, if they've said to fix your fender, it's 10 hours. Judge Sykes' question. So it's 10 hours, and then the price that's charged the customer will be 10 hours times the hourly rates of the people who worked on it, or is it it's just a flat thing? I see. So
they have
10 hours is the price.
Right.
There's some number connected with it.
Right. And then you add those up for all the tasks, and that's the overall number for repairing that car.
We're just thinking about if you're the customer, you pay the booked hours times some number.
Exactly.
And that number is irrelevant.
And that number varies some depending on what the various tasks are that go into them.
That's right. But what you're saying is the booked hours are the price, and that what they're getting, these people, is a percentage, not exactly a percentage of that price, but they're getting a percentage
relative
that is
to their
related
contribution.
To the price, because booked hours is in the percentage computation.
Right.
Well, and the harder and more efficiently the mechanics work, the more jobs they can complete in a day, the more money they can individually make and as a team make, and the more money the shop makes.
Precisely. The whole point of this system
is
to align the goals of the employees and the company and the consumers with each other.
Not the consumers. The employees and
sure.
The companies, I'll give you. The consumers, please don't go there.
All right, Your Honor.
Well, your argument is that the more efficient the company is, if it's a competitive industry, consumers benefit. Yeah.
Right. The sooner we can get the job done, deliver it, and do a good job, that means customer goodwill, it means people send back their friends, and it means we do better in the industry. And this whole system is aligned to try and achieve that goal. It's not designed to hurt the employees. The evidence shows that the employees do quite well under this system. So it's not trying to exploit anybody.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Heineke. So, Mr. Tarrant, I think his time expired, but you can have another minute. Yes, of course.
I think that one thing that Mr. Heineke's argument emphasizes is that there is nothing plain or unmistakable about this situation that brings it into the commission.
It's murky, that's for sure. It certainly has an element of a commission because the price to the consumer is a factor, right? It's not a conventional commission. I must say, where on earth did the judges, I hope not including myself, but who knows, get this idea of a clear and affirmative burden of proof? Where on earth did that come from?
That comes from the 11th Circuit decision in Birdwell.
But where did they get it from?
Well, I think they got it from the Supreme Court's
the
Supreme Court's decisions.
Don't they have burdens of proof without clear and affirmative?
Well, but we go back to Wolin. To Phillips versus Wool, and the whole concept that an exemption should be just that. It shouldn't be murky.
But whoever heard of some general rule that exemptions have to be proved by clear and affirmative evidence? Isn't enough to say exemption has to be proved? Burden of proof rests on the person urging the exemption.
Well, Your Honor, that is the standard that's been accepted by at least four other circuits.
And also, the issue here is not an evidentiary issue.
No, that's absolutely right. So what we come back to is the admonition of the Supreme Court that to further and advance the purposes of the Fair Labor Standards Act, you better hit that exemption.
The paradox here is that the actual purposes of the Act, whether they're safety, spreading work, preventing exploitation of marginal workers, they're not actually engaged here.
Well, indeed, I would disagree.
Back
that
to
they are
technology reigning, because these people are doing fine.
Well, we don't know that, since the majority of them are making under $25,000, and we would suggest that the reasoning of Judge Rustani and of the Wilkes decision, which are the only cases that applied the Mechmet standards and factors, both came out on behalf of the employees.
Why don't you have those people as the plaintiffs, then? I don't understand. Why don't you have plaintiffs like that?
I'm afraid I don't understand. Why do we have plaintiffs like...
You pick the most highly compensated.
Right. Well, there are highly compensated, but as Your Honor said in Mehmet, we're here to discern what the purpose is, not to moralize about the legislation.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 Tuesday.